Our lesson today is going to be on refugees mostly, and we're going to deal with them because there's so much misunderstanding about refugees, especially in Palestine area, and there's so much information, disinformation about it. I was reading a blogger today, just, you know, getting in to see what people say about stuff, and the person just says, well, it seems so unfair that all these people that are Palestinians are treated this way. I mean, it was just a statement like that. I said, don't you understand the background of all this? So it's easy to answer it on that level, and when you do that, you make really big mistakes. So we have to go back and talk about the bigger picture. That doesn't mean that there isn't trauma on the level of personal trauma on level each individual person, no doubt about that. But we're looking at the big picture because that's how you answer some of these questions from the big picture working in. So we're going to talk about this period of time we call now Israel as a new state, and we never can stay right on the date. We got to move before and after, and that's our period of time. We've got 5.5 months before the declaration of Israel as a state, and then we have about 8 months, and actually goes longer than that, goes to the summer of 1949. The reason that that end date is off or is not as flexible is because there are five nations that Israel enters into a truce agreement with, or an armistice agreement with, and so they're not all done on the same day. So that's why that day is not fixed like it is sometimes, like with World War I, we have Armistice Day, because it's mostly with Germany. But here we have a range of dates. But when you get to the end of 48, May 15, 1948, that year, you get into that, it's pretty well all settled. And we're in a period where now the nations are not suing for peace, but trying to work out some kind of armistice so that they can come back and engage in war again. See, that's why armistices are never really good, because there's a nervous end of hostility. It's just a interruption of hostility. So on the end there, I say normal war continues, which is kind of true. And so Israel is still in a state of war, or as are some of the people around them. Egypt and or Jordan are the only ones that have peace treaties with Israel yet. All right, so we are going to talk about the land. So I'm always interested in finding these little maps that kind of show it a little differently. This is a land that or a map that shows the promised land to Abraham, incorporated much more than a small sliver of land that we see today called Israel. It includes the area of Jordan, most of Lebanon, and most of Syria, and that's probably not exactly accurate either, but when it says it goes to the Euphrates River, I think probably mostly the direction it looks to then there is north, but it can look to the east too, because the Euphrates River does drop down into the Persian Gulf. So we have these three maps I put up side by side, and talk a little bit about the map since we have not talked a lot about Israel, you know, in its history. But the one in blue, this is the way that we think of Israel in the Bible. We think of Manasseh and Ephraim on this side and Reuben over here, and then the other tribes, some of them are half over here, clear down this way. So that's generally how we look at it. And next map I'll show you is Solomon's map, and that shows it much further north than what we usually think about Israel as the land. And this is the extent that the kingdom of Solomon, which was the biggest kingdom, the largest kingdom, was, that the extent of the Salamic kingdom. But we usually think of the kingdom in this size. And then we have the partition version of it. And you notice how solid it is through here. And I'll show you a comparison after it's partitioned, or after this, not partitioned. This is the partition. But after the War of Independence, a lot of this gets taken out. All of this gets taken out. Some more of this gets taken out. So I'll show you that. So this is how it was partitioned. And you see, Jerusalem is an island by itself. And then we have the part that we don't show here, which was part of Israel in the Bible times. We have Ephraim, Manasseh, and Reuben down here. Now, just for fun, I gave you a map of what Ezekiel talks about, shows in Ezekiel from chapter 40 to chapter 48, shows a division of the land in the millennial kingdom. And we see that the names of these tribes are less stacked up this way. And then here in the middle is where the temple is and the administrative offices of the kingdom, so to speak. And then below this, we have some more of the 12 tribes. Now, this is a huge spot in the middle here, I think something like 50 miles square. So, and the temple is in the middle of that, so there is not a lot of concern. You know, you've heard me talk about the location of the Temple Mount. I don't think that where it is really a big of significance, because in the Millennial Kingdom, it won't be where it is now anyway. So it'll be moved off site. So we have this as an sort of a point of interest about the land. And then these, depends on which map you look at. Some people think that these divisions go clear over to the right to the Euphrates River, and they would cut across the desert, which could be. So we just don't know exactly, but they are stacked up this way in the book of Ezekiel. And someday, if I live long enough, I might be able to do Ezekiel. Till then, we'll wait. So here we have the same map. And against this idea that this map shows the extent of the eastern border of the Millennial Kingdom land goes clear to the Euphrates River on the east. Now, this is all desert in here. That's why it's called the Fertile Crescent, because you can't go through there. You go around it. But when the day comes when the desert will blossom, then we won't worry about it being a desert. Then we have another map. Some of us know Manfred Kobar. He's I don't know whether he drew this himself or whether just conceptually his idea, but he's from Des Moines, Iowa. He's been on one of our tours and hopefully maybe another one. But he puts this into a little graphic. And so here's the kingdom. Here's the temple in the middle. Shows it raised up, and these streams that run out of the temple floor. The streams get larger and larger. It goes to the east, it dumps into the Jordan River, and then they have the same thing on the west that dumps into the Mediterranean Sea. I personally think that this is not going to be a dead end anymore. It's now a dead end sea. I think there's going to be a renovation of the earth, and frankly, this is probably an exercise in futility, because we have no idea what the earth is going to look like. Like we have no idea what the earth looked like before the flood, we won't have any idea what the earth's going to look like after the renovation. But it's a valiant attempt, and I appreciate that. So anyway, he has a map of the land that shows the features that we know today, like Nazareth and Caesarea and Gaza Strip down here, so on. So Mount Nebo, Pisgah's lofty heights, so forth. And we have the ever-shrinking land, or ever-growing land that the Jews inhabit. This is before the partitioning, and this is when they were living in the mandated territory, as a mandated territory, and the green would be unassigned or would be occupied by the indigenous people, the Arabs. I'm calling Arabs, and they're always Arabs, but we'll just keep it simple calling that. Then at the partition, we have this look. So this white part is the Jewish land, and this is the Palestinian land, for lack of a better word. And then we have, after the war, 49, then we have this half a butterfly look. You know, it almost looks like a butterfly if you did the half. And you see it's quite a bit different than this. And one of the main features is that allows access to Jerusalem. When the land was partitioned, access to Jerusalem was cut off. And in the war of 1949, a battle for this road, the Burma Road, to get access to Jerusalem. And I thought we'd do that today, but we won't get to it. We'll try it next week, get some of these little pieces picked up. And then we look around today, and this is how it appears. And this is called the West Bank, and that's a misnomer, but that's what we know it as today. So the Palestinians have gambled away their holdings by not making peace with Israel. They continue to shrink their territory to nothing except the Gaza Strip now, which they barely hold on to because of terrorism that comes from it. And the people that live in Gaza, even the Arabs, which would wish that Israelis would come and take over it, because at least there would be peace there. Right now, it's just a place where there's a constant war and friction. So the war of 1949, I think in terms of cars, in terms of dates, that helps me remember. So remember, that was in 1940. What's this? When 1949, Ford came out, was the new style, and all the old cars started to look like new cars, and they pretty well have made that shift. Anyway, this is 1949 Ford, and so that way you can remember the war in 1948 and 49 from the model of the car. So the expected war of November 29, 1947, which is our first tick on the map over there. Once the United Nations voted to partition. Remember, the United Nations could not partition. It's sort of like, although my hanky down there, that's the partition plan. But unless somebody picks it up, it's useless. Somebody has to pick it up. And of course, Truman picked it up, and so did Russia, and then a bunch of other nations. So don't want to get confused. They're saying that the United Nations partitioned it. They recommended it. It was a 181 resolution, recommendation of partition. And since they recommend it, somebody of authority has to pick it up. Of course, the United States did. So that started in the nation of Israel, started in May 15, 1948. And it ended in the summer of 1949 with five truces. The war was waged by the Arabs in Jewish-mandated territories. They didn't have war in the Palestinian territories. The Jews didn't go fight in the Palestinian territories. It was the Arabs came to fight in the Jewish territories. And there is no reason why international conquest laws do not apply. So if someone comes to your house and he drops his billfold, the robber, and he leaves, and then he gets arrested, and you say, well, did you find my billfold there? And you'd say, yes, I did. Well, he'd said, I like it back. I said, I'm sorry, it's mine. You dropped it in my house. You were a violator of my territory. What you leave is mine. So that is the way it is with international law. If there's a belligerent nation, the territory that they lose in this belligerency is lost if they lose. I think it's the way that nations have to think twice about whether you really want to attack somebody else, because they could stand to lose the territory. So this aggressive action on the part of the Arabs cost them a lot, and I show that lot is in the red in this map. They gained 50% of the land, more than they had at the partition. So I made this point here, which I guess is pretty obvious. Now, we have this truce in the summer of 1949, and Ben-Gurion is the prime minister, and King Abdullah the first is, just King Abdullah is the king of Jordan, except we're not going to call it that yet. Jordan is over here. It's actually called Transjordan because it is Transjordan. Now, it's sort of confusing because the West Bank is Transjordan. So it depends on which side of the river you stand on, which trance it is. So, I mean, I'm reading this stuff, say, Transjordan, which Transjordan are we talking about? So I think I got it right. But to begin with, Jordan is called Transjordan because you're looking from the point of view of Israel, you look across, it's Transjordan. Then it just dropped the trance, and now it just becomes Jordan. So we can talk about not Ben-Gurion tonight, we can talk more about Abdullah. And there I really pointed out to you the differences between these two maps, largely this part in here. It's changed. This red here, you know, has been eaten up here. It shows it here. And clear up on top here, we have a lot of land that was gained in that 48-49 war. The war occurred on five fronts. This is Egypt. They actually came in with two fronts, one along the coast, like through Gaza, and this one came up towards the middle, towards Hebron. And then we have Jordan. We call it Jordan now. With some of a move on the land, on the city of Jerusalem. And then we have Iraq and Syria. And did I do that right? Oh, this is Jordan, too. And then this is Syria. And then this is Syria. And then up here is Lebanon. Iraq's in there somewhere. I missed it. It's so small, I can't see it. One of them is Iraq. And they do this, you know, somewhat in concert. I'm not sure that it's orchestrated well, but, you know, they attacked the border that was closest to them. And it didn't go well for Israel for about 10 days. And they ended up having to be pushed out of Jerusalem altogether. They weren't able to have any presence in Jerusalem at all. Even though it chose it to be an international territory, they were not allowed, you know, for them, the Temple Mount is everything. And so they were pushed out of that, and they were out of it until 1967. Yes. I'm going to guess around 20,000. In some ways, with all the military equipment they got in, you wonder how they could field an army the size they did. And we talked about that. If you want to see the movie Above and Beyond, you get an idea how they got that. And it's really remarkable, which is part of the plan, because they started amassing weapons in the early part of 48. Yeah. And they flew airplanes illegally out of the United States, bought them for $5,000, and equipped them and so forth, got a lot of them from Czechoslovakia. I remember talked about that a week ago or 2 weeks ago. So Above and Beyond, the movie, it's worth watching. It's not a Christian movie, though, so you're used to not watching Christian movies, I'm sure. Okay, now when we talk about the refugees, we're going to also talk about the West Bank a little bit. We're going to talk about Jordan's duplicity, you know, and the Arabs are pretty good at telling stories. Now, the West Bank of the Jordan River is occupied, or was, or is, occupied or annexed in 1950 by Abdullah. He's the first one. Remember, his brother was Faisal, who had Syria, and then his father was Hussein down in Mecca. He was a Sharif of Mecca. So we have a family thing here. And these are the people that the British worked with after World War I and made promises to them that they couldn't fulfill because it wasn't for them to give, because it was an international decision what was going to happen to this land, and whatever Britain said to it, they were out of space. So when Britain started acting unilaterally, like as if this was their land, they really made some mistakes that compounded down into history the issues that came up. But anyway, we have the West Bank, called the West Bank of the Jordan River, is occupied or annexed by the Jordan or the Transjordan people. Only the British and Pakistan, remember I threw my hanky down, says all it is going to be a hanky laying there unless somebody picks it up. Well, in this case, we had two that did pick it up, and they were Britain, of all things, and Pakistan. Well, Britain and the Mandated Territories, they've always favored the Arabs, not always. As soon as the Balfour Letter was issued and another leader came along, they turned back on their commitment and favored the Arabs, supposedly because of oil, which I think is a little silly, but, I mean, oil is not everything in the world, but it was to them. So when they declared this West Bank territory owned by Jordan, the nation, only Britain and Pakistan recognized it. The rest of them did not. And even their own Arab neighbors didn't recognize it, which we'll talk about. So the Hashemite Kingdom of the Jordan, ruled by King Abdullah Hussein, who died in 1952 in Jerusalem, assassinated by a radical Jordanian Palestinian, expecting that the king would make peace with Israel. And if you've been on the Temple Mount, you know, I have a picture of it here, where he was assassinated. So the West Bank, in March of 1948, remember, this is before the War of Independence, the British cabinet agreed. Now, the British and Jordans are together. They're kind of like this. The British cabinet had agreed that the civil and military authorities in Palestine should make no effort to oppose the setting up of the Jewish state. You know, but they've already given up on doing this, and so they said they're not going to oppose it, nor are they going to hinder, maybe we should just read this, should make no effort to oppose the setting up of the Jewish state or move into or stop any move from the Transjordan, which is Jordan, into what we call the West Bank, my arrow. In other words, they're not going to stop any of the Arabs from moving from the Jordan into the West Bank, which for them is Palestine. Once they get into that area, they go anywhere they want to. Remember, the restriction has always been on the Jews. There never has been any restriction on Arab immigration, which drives me crazy. If you're going to restrict one because the land can't contain it, you got to restrict the other side too, and they never did that. So here's the statement again. Of the Arabs can come in, but the Jews can't come in. And yet it was a mandate to give land to the Jews in the original. Well, the United States, together with the United Kingdom, favored the annexation, the so-called West Bank. The UK preferred to permit King Abdullah to annex the territory at the earliest date, while the United States preferred to wait until after the conclusion of the Palestinian Coalition Commission, which lasted a few years before it broke up because of its ineffectiveness. So the annexation, in a sense, went through. Because, you know, in order for it to stop, you'd have to send a military might. Somebody would have to stop this, and no one did that. The UN doesn't have guns big enough to do anything. So it just sat that way. So Jordan formally annexed the West Bank on April 24, 1950, giving all the residents in the West Bank Jordanian citizenship. Which would make sense. If you're going to annex it, they got to become citizens. The West Bank residents had already received the right to claim Jordanian citizenship earlier in 1949. Now, remember, this is after the war. So after the war, Abdullah goes in with his army, claims Jerusalem, claims West Bank. He says, it's mine. All right, now the Arabs are watching him do this. So the Jordan's annexation was widely regarded as illegal and void by the Arab League and others. Remember this whole idea in Genesis we read about that they can't get along with each other. One hand, his brother's hand is against him. And that is what we see here. We don't see unity here at all from these Arab nations, which you'd expect that they would get together and join hands, but they don't. So we have this Elihu, I don't know who this Lauterbach is, described it as a move that entirely lacked legal justification, but it happened. The annexation formed part of Jordan's Greater Syria plan. Now, these expansionist policies in response, Saudi Arabia, Lebanon, Syria joined Egypt in demanding Jordan's expulsion from the Arab League. A motion to expel Jordan from the League was prevented by dissenting votes from Yemen and Iraq. They couldn't do it because they have the votes. But see, we have disunity here when we have Abdullah really unilaterally decides he wants the West Bank. It's supposed to be a Palestinian state, so he takes it. And everybody stands around and watches it and really don't know what to do except try to kick him out of the Arab League, and they can't do it because they don't have the votes. So there he sits with the land. So on June 12, 1950, the Arab League declared the annexation of a temporary annexation. We'll let you do it for a while. Well, that's kind of like forever, isn't it? If you'd let them do it for a while. So a practical measure that Jordan was holding the territory as a trustee pending a further settlement, you know, kick the can down the road. While entering a mosque in the Jordanian sector, which is on the Temple Mount, East Jerusalem, King Abdullah of Jordan, assassinated by the Palestinian nationalists, fearing Abdullah will make a peace with Israel. That's why he was shot. And here we have the steps and arches. If you've been there, you've been through those arches. It was on these steps where he was assassinated. And I kind of remember that. 51, I would have been 14, 13 or 14, something like that. I'd just given up the bottle. Okay, now Abdullah was a member of the Hashemite family. Remember that would trace the descendancy back to Muhammad. During World War I, the British support, this little review for you, Abdullah led an Arab revolt against the Turkish rule. Remember, Turkey ruled this territory, not the Arabs, the Turks did. And his brother Faisal's father, Hussein bin Ali Sharif of Mecca, kind of the big guy, they thought as a family, oh no, they ought to have power over all this area. You know, we always have talked about the Arabs. They're not exactly content to have a little. They want more. I mean, like anybody else does. But they don't think about it in terms of elections or democratic. They think of it as in terms of a sheikh. You know, they run the place. So the more room, the more camels, you know, all that. So that's what they intend. And Faisal got Syria for a few months till the French deposed him. But as far as the British were concerned, even though they promised it to him, they didn't have the right to promise it to him. They did give it to him. League of Nations did nothing about it. And so in a sense, it worked, although all legal, illegal. In 1921, the British made him the Emir of Transjordan, talking about Abdullah here, with Jordanian independence in 1946. He became the country's monarch. 2 years later, he led his armies against the newly declared State of Israel, and Jordan annexed Jerusalem along with the portions of Palestine that we know as the West Bank. In 1951, his efforts to create an Arab federation under Hashemite rule ended when he was assassinated in Jerusalem. So now I've heard that three times. Interesting today that our president was meeting with us, Abdullah number two, a king of Jordan. I think he's a relatively nice guy. I think that I think right now Jordan is probably the safe haven for an Arab. Saudi Arabia, we were there 14. Our guide said that Saudi Arabia gave them $1 billion to build the infrastructure up. I said, why did they do that? Because it's the safest place they got to put their money in the Middle East right now. And it may be as corrupt like all of them are, but there is some hope that maybe there'll be something coming out of it. And some of you were there, you saw the hotel they're building. It's incredible. And it was supposed to be some kind of number like $1 billion. So anyway, this is the young guy. He seems to be westernized, you know, like his let's see, what's he know? Would his father? Yeah, like his father would have been. He had an American wife, I think, educated in America. He's been educated in America. So as soon as you have that Western influence, you sort of have a little different feel for the kingdom. So I remember when we were there, they talked about the refugees from Syria that they're amassing on the northern border of Jordan. And part of what they were doing for Jordan itself was bring water in, fresh water, by pipe. They showed the pipe, they were building it, and say, well, this really was supposed to be for Amman, but because of the refugees, they're bringing it to the refugees, letting the refugees have it. So, well, that's really pretty good. So I think that Abdullah here, I would admire him. He's probably the most sane person in the Middle East these days from the Arab standpoint, and I think he's doing what he can with what he has. But he is also very much threatened by ISIS and so forth because he won't toe the line. He's the guy, by the way, he's the guy that threw out, we talk about this later, he threw out the PLO out of his country. And they went to Lebanon. And Lebanon didn't want him. And you know who escorted Arafat out of Lebanon? Our military. There are certain things you just sometimes wonder about. Why in the world did they do this? So anyway, that's a future lesson. All right, so I'm giving a lot of praise to Abdullah here. So we have the first Abdullah, the first, his son, Talal, is deposed for incompetency. I don't know how you do that. He lasted a year. I guess you can be so bad you throw him out. But he must have been. I've heard that. Jesus was worthless. So anyway, they got his brother, which is the father of this man, ruled till 1999. And then this son now is ruled to the present day. On July 27, 1953, King Hussein of Jordan announced that East Jerusalem was the alternative capital of the Hashemite kingdom. Now, he's got one already, Amman. I don't understand this. So we're going to have another capital in Jerusalem and would form an inseparable part of Jordan. So he is really claiming the West Bank and Jerusalem as his territory. In address to Parliament in Jerusalem in 1960, Hussein called the city the second capital of the Hashemite Kingdom of Jordan. I scratched my head. I have no idea where he gets this from. So the typical Arab subterfuge is evident in Abdullah's land grabbing. Now, this is the other one, be his grandfather. The typical Arab subterfuge is evident in Abdullah's land grabbing scheme. He did away with it. He did get away with it. Now no Arab state could be set up when he controls it. I mean, it's supposed to be an Arab state set up there. Well, if he runs it, how can you have an Arab state? You have to first of all depose the one that are there. Nor is he at peace with the Arab neighbors over Jordan, because Israel took it from him from under their noses. So in the Six-Day War, 1967, Israel recovers the land out of a war of aggression by the Arab nations. They attacked. Israel actually attacked first, but it was a defensive move. Everybody agrees to that. Now Jordan must administer the Palestinians. Jordan must administer these Palestinians under the ultimate control of Israelis, because now Israelis control it, but still you have this two-tiered government. In time, the West Bank will become a heavyweight on Abdullah's kingdom. Most Jordanians live in the West Bank. The population center is now over in Israel. The more people live in what's called Israel territory than live in Jordan. Because there's 20,000 administrators in the West Bank taking care of people there. And I said, I can't imagine that. I don't think there are 20,000 people there when we drove through it to look at it. So it becomes a burden around the Jordanian's neck. So in July 31, 1988, he cedes all control of the territory, the Palestinian West Bank, to the PLO. And at that time, it's run by Arafat. And we'll talk more about Arafat later. But I want you to say that this idea that he's going to grab this land and make it part of Jordan just didn't work out very well because it was such trouble for him. And I don't know enough about it, but I've been told much trouble there was for him that you're just better off without it. So he gives up on it. Now, remember, it's still under Israel's control. I mean, the PLO they're in a short chain, and it's only what Israel allows them to do that they actually can do, because if they can do what they want to do, they'd kick Israel out. So that obviously that won't work. So Okay, so now we return to the War of Independence, May 15. This is, we have the little flag-raising monument, Hiroshima, is that right? And we have one for Israel. That's kind of a famous picture. And I want to do something for you today. Thought about this. I'm going to add another one to our personalities on the Jewish frontier, the Jewish stream. I'm going to add Golda Meir here. I admire her as a leader. She's kind of a Deborah of the Old Testament in many ways. She's a Jew. She's not a believer. None of these people are believers that I know of, certainly not professed to be. But she was a key instrument in the life of Israel in the development stage here. Now, by the way, Deborah's in Judges 4 if you want to look her up. In a speech that she remembered as, quote, unscheduled, unrehearsed, unannounced, at the General Assembly of Jewish Federation and Welfare Funds in Chicago, January 21, 1947, Golda Meir spoke so compellingly that she raised twice, which was $50 million for the Haganah military. The amount requested was 25. They only could raise 8 or 10 million. They said, this is not going to be enough to fight a war. And we talked about flying airplanes out of the United States, buying them at 5,000. They got to be refurbished, got to be re-equipped, you got to fuel them, all this stuff. Where did they get this money from? Well, they needed the money and Golda went out to get it. The president of Israel was going to go and she said, no, let me go. So, and she was probably the right one to go. Okay, Golda Meir was born in the Ukraine, in Kiev, was raised in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. That's why she doesn't have this accent. She's now deceased. Was it trained as a teacher during the year in Denver where she lived with an older sister. She discovered Zionism and became her lifelong passion. Now, Jordan's intention, November 17, 1947, this is before the vote, 10 days before the vote, just before the partition vote, Golda Meir meets secretly with Jordan King Abdullah. Remember, that's the first one, not, you know, which one we're talking about here. Abdullah wants the Jewish state to become part of Transjordan. In other words, I'll be here and you come underneath me here. So this is the Transjordan group, and then Israel, I want you to sit underneath here. So he wants a Jewish state to become part of the Transjordan, a Jewish state within an Arab state idea. Meir refuses. Well, Abdullah already proposed to take over the Arab part of the partition that was going to be offered by the UN. Remember, this is before it was even partitioned. He already had his designs on it. So he's just a normal guy that wants to have a bigger kingdom. Nothing wrong with that, I guess. Meir indicated that the Jewish state will not actively support this move, their move to take over the West Bank, but would acquiesce if it is temporary. Well, what's she going to do? Really had no power, so she'd have to say that. January 1948, now this is still before the war, independence, the treasurer of the Jewish agency was convinced that Israel would not be able to raise more than $7 or $8 million from American Jewish community. Meir traveled to the United States, raised $50 million, told you this already, which was used to purchase arms in Europe for the young country. Ben-Gurion was the one that was going to go, but Meir went instead. Wrote that Meir's role as a Jewish woman who got the money which made the state possible would go down one day in the history books. And that's why I brought her in here. I figured without this money, it probably wouldn't have happened. So we put up people that have made such a contribution that without them, it wouldn't have happened. So that's why she's here. Now, on May 10, 1948, 4 days before the official establishment of Israel, Meir traveled to Amman, second trip now, to see Abdullah. They're getting to be friends. Disguised as an Arab woman. There's a movie about this, by the way. There's a movie about everything. Even your life, probably, somewhere. An Arab woman with a special, with a secret meeting with King Abdullah I of Transjordan, at which she urged him not to join the other Arab countries in attacking the Jews. They wanted to be friends. And really, I think when it gets down to it, Abdullah really didn't want to do it. But because of the disgrace he would feel from his brothers, he was forced into it. And this is certainly true in 67. Especially when they tricked him. We'll talk about that when we get to it. You know, these guys don't, the Arabs will do bad things to each other. So anyway, there's not all this peaches and cream going on here with these guys. So Abdullah asks her not to hurry the proclamation of the state, and Mir replies, well, we've been waiting for 2,000 years. Is that hurrying? I thought it was probably good. And she didn't even have her history, right? She could add another 500 years to it, because they had not really been an independent nation since 586 BC. So there are a lot of myths out there about the Palestinian situation. And it's probably the one that's hardest to knock down, is because you go out there and you look at it is today and you read the headlines today and you get a totally, don't have any background, because news reporting today doesn't do background work. It just, how does someone feel about something? And that's the end of it. So it's difficult to dig in. That's why we do this class, understand what really is going on. So the myth is that Jews created the refugee problem by expelling the refugees. I want to give you a little comment, and we'll use it again at the end or later on, about Golda Meir's attitude toward the Palestinians there. As head of the Jewish Agency political department, Meir called that the mass exodus of Arabs before the War of Independence 1948 was dreadful, and that she likened it to what happened to the Jews in Nazi-occupied Europe. So there's no vindictiveness here. So that's kind of how she thinks. Now, had the Arabs accepted the 1947 UN resolution, not a single Palestinian would have become a refugee. Now, that's a stretch to say that, but that's what I want to talk about this evening. An independent Arab state would now exist beside Israel. Now, in all honesty, the Bible doesn't support that's what would happen. So we have to have that always there. You know, what did the Bible say is going to happen? Well, that's not what's going to happen. But look at it from a human standpoint of view. As far as Israel is concerned, in their dry bone stage, it could have happened. It certainly wasn't because of them that it didn't happen. And the responsibility for the refugee problems rise with the Arabs. Oh, and I forgot to bring the quote we had about 2 weeks ago, where we had Russia absolves Israel of any responsibility with the Palestinians. I mean, it was one of those kind of things. Wow, really? Because they understood what had happened. So that's why we're going to talk about it. In the beginning of the Arab exodus can be traced to weeks immediately following the announcement of the UN partition resolution. The first to leave were roughly 30,000 wealthy Arabs who anticipated the upcoming war and fled to neighboring Arab countries to await its end, which makes total sense, I guess. Less affluent Arabs from the annexed cities of Palestine moved to all Arab towns to stay with their friends and relatives in a safer spot. By the end of January 1948, this is again before the announcement of the independence, the exodus was so alarming that Palestinian Arab Higher Committee asked neighboring Arab countries to refuse visas to these refugees and seal their borders against them. They're losing their people. On January 30, 48, the Jaffa newspaper reported that fifth column consists of those who abandon their houses, businesses, and go to live elsewhere. At the first sign of trouble, they take to their heels and escape, sharing the burden of struggle. Now, that's an Arab paper talking about themselves. Another Jaffa paper, March 30, 1948, excoriated Arab villages near Tel Aviv for bringing down disgrace on us all by abandoning their villages. Meanwhile, a leader of the Arab National Committee in Haifa, the Arab soldiers in Jaffa, were mistreating the residents. This is Arabs mistreating Arabs. The Arab soldiers robbed individuals' homes. Life was of little value, and the honor of women was defiled. The state of affairs led many Arab residents to leave the city under the protection of the British tanks. This wasn't safe. John, don't know his name here, don't know him, the commander of the Jordan's Arab Legion, said, villages were frequently abandoned, even before they were threatened by the progress of war. Contemporary press reports of major battles in large numbers of Arabs fled conspicuously, failed to mention any forcible expulsion by the Jewish forces. The Arabs are usually described as fleeing or evacuating their homes, while Zionists are accused of expelling and dispossessing the Arab inhabitants of such towns as Tiberias and Haifa. The truth is much different. Both of these cities were within the boundaries of the Jewish state under the UN protection scheme, and both were fought for by Jews and Arabs alike. You know, there are a lot of Arabs that live in Palestine, in the land today, and they're totally welcome. They have voting rights, so they didn't leave. And they are glad to be there because they have jobs. Jewish forces seized Tiberias in April 1948, and the entire Arab population of 6,000 was evacuated under British military supervision. The Jewish Community Council issued a statement afterward: "We did not dispossess them. They themselves chose this course. Let no citizen touch their property." They said the Israelis protected the property of the Jew, of the ones that had left. I'm not sure how far that goes, because finally when they're gone, they don't come back. Then what? In early April, an estimated 25,000 Arabs left the Haifa area following an offensive by the irregular forces led by Fazi, whoever, and rumors that Arab air forces would soon bomb the Jewish areas around Mount Carmel. April 23, the Haganah captured Haifa. The British police report from Haifa, dated 26 April, explained that every effort is being made by the Jews to persuade the Arab populace to stay and carry on with their normal lives, to get their shops open for business, and to be sure that their lives and interests will be safe. In fact, David Ben-Gurion sent Golda Meir to Haifa to try to persuade the Arabs to stay, but she was unable to convince them because of their fear of being judged traitors by their own Arabs, because of the Arab cause. By the end of the battle, some more than 50,000 Palestinians had left. Remember, Meir said that he called this mass exodus of Arabs before the War of Independence dreadful. She didn't say, "Boy, I'm glad they're gone." So tens of thousands of Arab men, women, children fled towards the east. This is still in Haifa. Cars on foot in desperate attempt to reach Arab territory until the Jews captured the Rushmeh Bridge, which you see here, towards Samaria and northern Palestine and cut them off. Want them to leave, I guess. Thousands rushed every available cart, craft, rowboat along the waterfront to escape by sea towards the north, towards Acre. I'm not saying they didn't leave. The question is, were they pushed out? Were they run out? Now, the war would do that, make you want to go to where it's safe, but that's a different issue. The same day, April 23, 1948, Husseini, the chairman of the Palestinian Higher Committee, told the UN Security Council that, indeed, instead of accepting the Haganah's truce offer, the Arab preferred to abandon their homes, their belongings, and everything they possessed in the world and leave town. The U.S. Consulate General in Haifa wrote in April 22, 1948, all still before the war started, before the independence started, for example, that local multi-dominated Arab leaders were urging all Arabs to leave the city, and large numbers did so. The U.S. Consulate in Haifa wrote April 22, 1948, for example, that multi-dominated Arab leaders were urging all Arabs. I read that, didn't I? Yeah, I think I did that. I do sometimes get something copied twice. An army order issued July 6, 1948, made clear that Arab towns and villages were not to be demolished or burned, and that Arab inhabitants were not to be expelled from their homes. And that's true, because those that didn't leave are still there. Sometimes, well, they did, but they didn't. They did that to those that left. The number of Jews fleeing Arab communities for Israel in the years following Israel's independence was nearly double that of Arabs leaving Palestine. So many Jews were allowed to take little more than this. This is from other countries. So this is my next panel. These countries where the Jews were run out of. So what he's saying is that all the numbers that Jews that were run out of here, not just left voluntarily, were run out, equal about the number of Palestinians that left on their own accord. So it ended up being somewhat of a cemetery there. So where was I here? Many Jews were allowed to take little more than the shirts. That's from the Northern Africa and these other areas. Little to assert about them because they did not remain refugees for long. They didn't become refugees. They were absorbed. Of the 820 Jewish refugees between 1948 and 1972, 586,000 were resettled in Israel at great expense and without any offer of compensation from the Arab government, who confiscated the possessions. So we have the refugees leaving, and we have the territories from which they came. And if we could read, there are 100,000, there's 38,000, 75,000, and so forth. The numbers are huge. Israel has consistently maintained that any agreement to compensate the Palestinian refugees must also include Arab reparation for Jewish refugees. And to this day, the Arab states have refused to pay anything for the hundreds of thousands of Jews that were forced to abandon their property before fleeing the country. So it's one that's kind of, one matches the other. In numerous instances, Jewish leaders urged Arabs to remain in Palestine and become citizens of Israel. The Assembly of Palestine Jewry issued this appeal in October 2, 1947. We will do everything in our power to maintain peace, establish a cooperation gainful to both Jew and Arab. It is now here and now, from Jerusalem itself that a call must go out to the Arab nation to join forces with Jewry and the desolate Jewish state and work shoulder to shoulder for our common good, for the peace and progress of sovereign equals. Israel's propagation of independence, and this is on their day of independence, May 14, 1948, also invited the Palestinians to remain in their homes and become equal citizens of the new state in the midst of wanton aggression. We yet call upon the Arab inhabitants of the state of Israel to preserve the ways of peace and play their part in the development of the state on the basis of full and equal citizenship, due representation in all its bodies and institutions. We extend our hand in peace and neighborliness to all the neighboring states and the peoples and invite them to cooperate with the independent Jewish nation for the common good of all. Those are official statements. Now we have one from Abbas, Muhammad Abbas, the head of Abbas. The Arab armies entered Palestine to protect the Palestinians from the Zionist tyranny, that's his way of saying it, but instead they abandoned them. The Arabs abandoned their own people, forced them to immigrate and leave their homelands, and threw them into prisons similar to the ghettos in which the Jews used to live. That's from their own leader, who still lives today, who was elected, who was put in office for 4 years, 10 years ago, and never have had an election yet. So we don't have normal processes of government when it comes to Arabs. They generally take office and hold office. We see that in Syria. We've seen that in Iraq. We see that everywhere. So that's true here, too, as well. Now, let's talk about the refugees. War always produces refugees. We're seeing it in Syria now. You know, we really feel bad for these. I do, at least. I hope you do. These poor people, these girls and boys that are little guys, and they have no idea what they're going. All they did to get born to the world. So the whole thing is a tragedy in itself. But they can be an impersonal weapon. These are personal people, but used as an impersonal weapon in the hands of belligerent powers. And that's what we're seeing. Public opinion tends to favor the refugees, of course, and blame the country of destination, where they're going. They don't let them in. We hear that. Rather than the country of origin that drove them out or made the conditions so they had to leave. So, and the refugees are not monolithic, and they carry within their masses the unwanted in both countries. To withstand a national crisis of security, each immigrant must be vetted before admission. And some think that's a new thought. Camps are set up as holding refugees until they can be safely examined and admitted. In the meantime, some will die of neglect, disease, and probably of old age. We saw a lot of that in Europe. The Palestinian refugee is the most odd of all refugees seen in the world. I mean, I'm not that acquainted with all the refugees in the world, but this is so odd, it's remarkable. So before we make any comments on these refugees, it must be pointed out that of all the refugees in modern time, these refugees are the most politicized group ever. In other words, somebody's playing with them. Refugees are usually absorbed in one generation. The Palestinian refugees now are grand and great-grandparents. When we were in the first trip, we went to Jordan in 1983. Our guide now has died. His name is Tony, and he was our guide again in 14, whenever we went back there. And he told me then, 83, that his parents were Palestinian refugees. Really? Yeah, they're living in Oregon. Do I have to say anything else? All right. So there's something going on here. So is it possible to call the children of refugees refugees? How long do you hold the immigration status? The children of immigrants are not immigrants, are they? My great-grandparents immigrated to the United States. Their parents were not immigrants. I'm not an immigrant. No, and we're not a nation of immigrants. Maybe somebody was, but people have lived here. If you're born here, you're not an immigrant. So we hold on to these designations for some reason. The children of immigrants are not immigrants. Can refugee status be noted in wills as a commodity? I'm a refugee. I will my refugee status to you, Pat. I mean, it's almost like that's how can this be? I said the Jews came in from northern Africa, and there were no refugees. They got absorbed. You know, which means you take care of them. You feed them. You clothe them. Give them a place to, at great expense. But that's what you do if they're your people. So now we have refugees that have grandchildren, great-grandchildren, because I would have been a refugee. I was born in 37, so I'd be a young person during this time. I would have been 11, 10 years old. So now I'm a great-grandparent. So if I was been a refugee, I'd have great-grandchildren and still be a refugee. Something wrong with this. These and many more questions swirl around the phony refugee status. Now, I don't mean that the individual person doesn't have trouble, but the status that we build for them is phony. Most troubling of all of these is the deception. The deception that accompanies this victimhood status for these 7 years, and it's been built. Yasser Arafat did a good job of that. Kept it alive. Okay, the Arab nations really do not care about the refugees. You just look around and see what they do for them. Now, again, Jordan is about as good as you can get. We drove by their refugee camp. You know what they're called now? Apartments. The first trip, some of you were with us the first trip. We went by that place, and the next time we went there, same trip, we didn't go by it. So, but they were the refugees. Can they get jobs? Sure. Do they work? Yeah. So this idea that these refugees are loose and they don't have anything, it just come in Jordan at least, it's just not true. It's if they don't want to, then obviously they maintain that status for whatever it's worth. So Arab nations do not care one whit about the refugees, shown by the continued politicizing of the people. Jordan has done the best of all the nations, as far as I can tell. Yet today, they live in permanent apartments as refugees. It seems like some of the refugees are scamming the system, prefer UN money rather than getting a maybe lower-paying job. I don't know. Maybe they get a high-paying job. The United States and UN and others who help the refugees have been willfully duped, to believe that money is needed to relieve the refugee status when in reality it compounds it. That's why I like to go into my economic studies here. How does economics work? One thing you don't help but somebody with is give them money and give them money and give them money. Kind of like a dope addict. You never get them well if you keep giving them the drugs. So the assistant funds go to the Palestinian leadership. Now, I was going to look up how much money the United States or UN gives these guys, but probably that would make me, whatever. I didn't get a chance to, but I know it's millions. And that's where it goes. It goes to leadership, and they're supposed to distribute to the poor people. Well, you can figure out what happens to it. The assistant fund goes to the Palestinian leadership, and refugees continue in their tents, apartments, with no hope and willful despair, yet the countries of their own blood will not let them in or put them on a path to citizenship. Therefore, the refugees are fed a mixture of assistance and blatant deception that continue to haunt their victimness. And there is an easy solution. It will fix this in one generation. You just cut off the funding. It will be difficult. It will be difficult, but that's how you do it. You know, I don't know if any of you guys got a 40-year-old boy live in your house yet or not, but sometime you got to get them out. Well, it's going to be hard for them because they have to work for themselves. Yes, that's kind of what life is called. There's four things in the world we'll have to face with. We've been created. There's a fall. We've been kicked out of the garden. There's been a flood, and there's been a confusion at Tower of Babel. We live in a dangerous world. Those things make our world dangerous. We're not in the kingdom yet. So the easy solution to fix this problem in one generation is to cut off the funding, and this foe Palestinian government will starve to death in a matter of a few years. No one will support it. No one knows. Arabs won't support it. Only one will support the United States, maybe the UN, which is always funded by the United States. I'm not being critical tonight. I'm just thinking this is how it is. So for summary now, refugee and Palestinian question continues to promote a two-state solution, which, as we will see in the future, is an effort at no-state solution for Israel. Go back to Gola just a little bit, what else he did here. Remember Stalin's intervention to swamp the European refugee camps with Jews? to make Britain look bad. Well, Gola went to Russia and instilled in them a vision for Zionism. Zionism did not catch on in Russia until Golda Meir made a visit to the synagogue. Here's a picture of her, and if you look real carefully, there's a circle around that face. That must be her. During her brief stint in the USSR, Meir attended Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur service at Moscow Choral Synagogue, where she was mobbed by thousands of Russian Jews chanting her name in Israeli. 10,000 shekels banknote issued in November 1984 bore a portrait of Meir on one side, an image of the crowd on the other side. They honored her for that. Before Golda visited the Jews, they were cool to make the aliyah, which is the word for going to Israel as a Jew, return to the lands, aliyah. But she turned their hearts to Israel. I just had to throw that in there somewhere. Civil war broke out. First date back in there, November 30th, after the partition vote. The Arabs, believing the days of their land were numbered, a false fear, as we've seen. They were judging the Jews on the basis of their own intentions. Important. They judged the Jews on their own intentions. It would not be a stretch to conclude that if the Arabs had accepted UN partition plan, that a civil war would not have broken out, because the Jews wouldn't have fought them. The Jews never intended to ethnically cleanse the land, and when given the opportunity, never have, and they're still living there. I mean, that's proof. Many Arabs live in peace in the land today. We've seen them. They're wealthy, well-to-do Arabs. So we have the civil war territories that could have been had, were foolishly squandered by Arabs thinking they could bowl over the Jewish people and have all the land. So this civil war lasted 5.5 months. We're talking about the first, I could call it a civil war before it actually goes to the international war. The civil war, 5.5 months, was a practice war, a war of warning to prepare for a serious conflict. Weapons were very limited, but are secured in 1948, before and after Independence Day. Some of the fighter planes were assembled after they were flown in, smuggled in, but in parts from America and from Czechoslovakia. Some of those were never tested in flight, and when they were up in the air, they had to go fight, and some of them were not put together well, and they were shooting between the blades of the propellers, and once in a while they shot the propellers off. I mean, the coordination has to be perfect. So the partition passed the UN by 33 votes, 13 against, 10 abstaining. Britain was one of those. And the mandate expired 5.5 months later, and everybody knew that, and that's why they were fighting. So we have these five wars, five nations. I'm not going to stop here anymore. We've got Egypt, Jordan, Assyria, Iraq, Syria, and Lebanon attack at one time. And if you go to Israel and you go, if you remember, if you come down on the south end of the Sea of Galilee, you come down the hairpin turns after we've seen the bridge that got blown up on the day of the night of the bridges, you come to this place where this little tank sits. And it was the tank that's there as a memorial to the Syrian defeat in 1948. So that's at the bottom of that arrow there. I put that up there. We will go through all of these. It's too much work. All these, you know, how all these five got defeated is more than we can handle, more than I can handle. So we have Jordan's ambition. We talked about that already. Talked about Genesis 16:11. Says his hand will be against everyone. Everyone's hand will be against him, which says that there cannot be unity between these people. The example of this is the subterfuge of King Abdullah, designs for the divided off territories of the partition plan. The land was to be a state for the Palestinians, but Abdullah wanted to add it to his own kingdom, supposing that the British favored him. And after all, he did get the Transjordan from them illegally, so I thought he'd get some more. We saw earlier that Abdullah tries to strike a secret deal with Israel for them to cede the land to them rather than fight for it, thereby going the independent Arab nation. I'm trying to rush through this. It was recognized that only Britain and Iraq, Pakistan, recognizes annexation, so forth. In invading, Arab forces took control of the Arab areas and immediately attacked the Israeli forces and several Jewish settlements. 10 months of fighting, interrupted by several truce periods, took place mostly on the former territory of the British Mandate, not in the Arab territories, and for a short time in the Sinai Peninsula, southern Lebanon. Now note this, no state was created for the Palestinian Arabs. No state was created. Why not? I threw my hanky down. There it is. UN says, there it is. And the Jews picked it up. The Arab says, what is it? Well, one thing, Jordan took the land. He took the major piece. So what you going to do? They had nothing in place, so forth, to start a nation. So the demographic changes, 700,000 out and 700,000 come in. We'll talk about the Jews. It's interesting how that works out. I've talked about that. I'm out of time. Egypt invades Israel. Leave that go. They get defeated. Then we have the second part of the international war, and there's two engagements. There's a couple of ceasefires, and then we have the armistices. So this victory is lost to the Arab. The end is better for the Israelis, but much worse for the five Arab nations in the summer of 1949. The Jews have been agreeable to various plans that would have permitted a defendable state. They get all kinds of, we even talk about the Peel Commission plan. While the Arabs had offered none. Have you ever noticed that there's never been an Arab plan offered? If Arab would offer them a plan, say, you do this and we'll, never been one. It's always Israel off one that's not good enough. So you have this. If Arabs would have offered a plan and set the condition, maybe they could have come out of it. But what we have here is actually, they will not talk until you put your land on the table. If there's no land on the table, then we're not going to talk. So that was their condition. So while the Arabs have offered no plan, they have set conditions to talk about a plan. But always land has to be given up, put on the table before talks can even begin. The Jewish Arab standoff is assisted by the peacekeeping brokers of other nations. And I think that our country means well. All the Western people want peace in the world, but sometimes they meddle. These would include the Friends of Israel, and I'm going to put the United States in here. We're going to put also the UN, others, maybe England, perhaps. Let's put names in here. But Friends of Israel, who believe that peace with the Arabs is possible. If only the Jews would be reasonable. That's usually the caveat. If the Jews would be reasonable, there'd be peace. So I say, then this is how the negotiation works. We have the Jew and the Arab stand crosswise in the middle of a bridge. The bridge goes this way, right? And they stand like this in the bridge. I stand one this way and one stands that way. All right? So we're across the bridge, facing each other. The peace brokers say to the Jew, take a step back and the Arab will make peace. And the dutiful Jew takes a step back. And the Arab says nothing, but takes a step forward. And he repeats this again and again, maybe, whatever. Obviously, the Arab is not satisfied, so the broker says to the Jew, well, take another step back, and the Arab will make peace. And the Jew says, so far, my two steps failed to bring peace. Why would I keep stepping back? I will fall off the bridge. And the Arab breaks the silence and says, then we'll have peace. So that is kind of how it is. You know, as long as there is a square foot of land, the Arab will not allow him to have it. And we're going to talk about, there's two times, one, I think, that idea of a two-state nation was offered and it was turned down once by Arafat. I don't know whether he was living the second time or not. But anyway, so this is exactly how it is negotiated. No wonder there can be no peace. Therefore, the War of Independence was a defensive war to prevent the destruction of the fledging Jewish state in the face of overwhelming Arab aggression. And that's a question about how much power they really had. There's this discussion about that now. The United Nations partitioned the land for all which belonged to Israel via the International San Ramos League in 1920-22. Should have had all of it. The British gave 75% of it, the land, to the Arabs, forming a British blessed and somewhat protected state of Jordan. And I say a large step backwards. 75% of land was given up. It's a big step backwards. Israel accepted the partition plan. The Arab moved in, accepted the partition plan. But he took another step back at the partitioning, at the mandate, but declared itself a state, which received immediate international recognition, essential to statehood, Israel did. The Arab refused and immediately went to war. For the next 19 years, the Arab state, or as it has come to be known, the Palestinian non-state, made no plans to form a government or prepare for a government. All their energy is poured into stopping Israel, either rather than Arab statehood. there is a positive climate for international recognition of a Palestinian state, which lasted until 1967. Could have been done, those 19 years, at which time no progress has been made towards nationhood. All efforts have been to eliminate, annihilate Israel by additional steps backwards. Remember, the issue the Jews had with the British mandate was the limitation of Jewish immigration without any restriction to the Arab immigration. That just was unfair. Limitation to land acquisition with no restrictions on the Arab. Remember, the Arabs invaded. The Arabs were invaders of Turkish lands. They were not residual there. Many of those came from Jordan. Conflict takes on the nature of an Arab being, now this is maybe not too kind. The conflict takes on the nature of the Arabs being a retarded brother who needs the other brother to take care of him. And I remember Steinbeck's movie of Mice and Men. It doesn't end the same way. No matter what the handicapped brother does, the other brother's violence and lethargy is accepted and understandable since he cannot do these things for himself. In the same way, the Arabs are seen as helpless, but hold the golden key to the future. And again, a false idea. Finally, as we talk about wars surrounding May 15, 1948, it helps us to have 68 years of history to see reality through the torrents of deception. One benefit is that it has forged an iron will resolve on the Jews not to give up the land, even though there are Jewish voices calling for appeasement, land for peace, or even more striking, some virulent anti-Zionist Jews who wish Israel would go away. And you'll find them all. You'll find them all. And it's a reminder to me that the bones that Ezekiel talks about are dry, and I might say very, very dry. So we wait for the day when the Lord will come and put those bones into motion by giving them the Spirit. All right, I'll be praying, and if you have questions, certainly come up here and talk. Let's pray. Thank you, Lord, for the evening again. Lord, we looked at our difficult time in history. It's not the first time it's been difficult. You look back in the history of the Jewish people, there's always been a difficult time for them because they are your chosen people. And all the criticism perhaps that we could lay at their feet may all be true, but it doesn't change the fact that they are chosen of you, and you are going to work through them, whether the humanity likes it or not. And it's through these people you brought us the Savior. We remember that. We remember that Jesus was a Jew and that he came to die on the cross for our sins. We realize that the world is engulfed in sin, and it is very often expressed even against your people whom you've called to be your own. Thank you, Lord, for Abraham and his descendants. Lord, someday the world will be ruled and reigned by them, and the world will be benefited by them in the kingdom. And we look forward to those days when all that conflict that we see today will be a matter of a faint history, even if it is remembered. And we are thankful to be alive during these days. We look back over these years and see how you've been faithful to that land and to the people. And it is really a faithfulness to your word rather than faithfulness to the people, because it's your word that's at stake. And Lord, we believe that word because it is your word. Thank you, Lord, for bringing us out. Keep us safe as we go home, and bring us again back next week, and pray it all in Jesus' name. Amen.